second part of the interview with Jack Nicklaus by William Burr took place on July 31st, 1986.
Mr. Nicklaus, how would you characterize Nixon's policy towards Iran during the early years of the administration? Was there much continuity from earlier periods? Was it a basically continuous policy?
Well, certainly the basic posture of the United States continued. That is to say that we remain interested in helping preserve Iran's independence and territorial integrity, bolstering its economy, and this meant continuing an aid program. It meant continuing military assistance, military advisors, and I think trying to add some depth and scope to the relationship in cooperative areas. For example, atomic energy was an area where we began to develop closer ties. Certainly at the very beginning of the Nixon administration, I don't recall any significant departures from that general broad policy direction.
Now, I read that in 1969, Henry Kissinger had the NSC prepare a report on the U.S. response to the British decision to pull out of the Gulf. Do you recall that report, or do you have any role?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. He requested a report from the State Department, and really not just explicitly from the State Department, I think it was from the government. And all people involved, but inevitably it turned out that we ended up writing it. And we included myself and principally on one side, and Bill Brewer, who was at the time the country director for the Arabian Peninsula, on the other side. And we tried to foresee what would impact of British withdrawal from east of the Suez and its implications for the United States, and to predict, hopefully with some accuracy, what the internal developments would be in the, particularly in the Emirates, but also, of course, with respect to Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Iran.
Did they make any particular recommendations on policy that you recall?
This paper was a long and agonizing process. I recall that distinctly. Actually, as I recall it, was set in motion before I arrived, so I entered the process sort of mid-flight. It still took about another 4, 5, or 6 months to finally complete. And I'm trying to recall the general thrust of the recommendations. And I'm not being very successful in doing that. I think there was some implication that we were going to have to contemplate the necessity of playing a more significant military security role in the area than we had in the past. I don't recall that we said specifically what we thought that ought to be. We may have, but I just don't remember it. I do think we said fairly explicitly that we would probably have to help all of the countries in the area to the extent that we could and to the extent that they desired to enhance their own military capabilities, since the British shield was, at least insofar as the Arabian Peninsula is concerned, was going to be no longer present.
One issue that came up in 69, I think, was had to do with military credits. Under Johnson, the credits have been limited to $100 million a year. I think there was a sort of credit transfers provided for sales of arms.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the middle of 69, the Shah wanted to increase the credit tranches. Wanted to get approval from the U.S. for that increase. Do you recall anything about what the upshot of the U.S. response to that was? That might be pretty detailed. That might be a specific question.
Well, I can't say that I do recall that in specific detail. Again, there was this sort of constant pressure from Iran to increase both on the military side as well as the economic side in those days. So that an incremental increase would not be something that stood out in my mind per se. It was just more of along the continuum. And it was going to maybe an extra dimension to that continuing demand. I really can't recall anything much beyond that.
I think one reason that the Johnson administration put a limit on credit was they were afraid it would cause strain on the domestic economy of Iran. Do those concerns still continue into the next administration?
Well, in the bureaucracy itself, you always had, and again, this was not a unique argument, but back to preceding era and periods. And continued, and you had this argument going on right up to 1978 in the bureaucracy itself, that this would put undue pressures on the civilian side of the economy, undue pressures on the available human resources on the bureaucracy, etc., etc.
Now, in September 69, the Shah made a visit to Washington.
That's right.
Did you have to make any special preparations for that visit? Or?
You always make special preparations for a state visit, which involve preparing the presidential briefing book, which means that you have a background setting type of paper. Then you get into specific issues and specific recommendations. And this is sort of SOP for any state, depending on the importance of the country and the complexity of the issues involved, why the book could be greater or thinner. But it's a fairly exhaustive and difficult exercise. And you get into the minutia of at 10:05, the Shah will do this, and 10:06, the President will do that sort of thing. I mean, a real whole scenario for the whole visit. Mm-hmm. And yes, we were deeply involved. Well, we wrote most of it.
Did this visit have any special significance that you can recall in terms of policy issues or otherwise?
Well, there are always policy issues. And there were always questions of the degree to which we would recommend to the President that we'd be responsive to anticipated requests on the part of the Shah. And these invariably involved questions of the amount of assistance we would provide, as well as the nature, the kinds of equipment that we would be willing to provide. So you were always escalating, as it were. from one level to the next on this continuum that I mentioned. I don't recall specifically. I think F-14s was a question at that time, whether we would be providing them, or if so, how many. And not having those papers readily available.
I think I read or heard during this visit that Shaw proposed to Nixon, or that someone at the firm proposed, that the U.S. agree to barter weapons for oil. Do you recall that in that connection?
I don't remember the precise timing, but we did get a proposal from the Shaw take oil, which we would, which he urged we could store against a rainy day, and for this oil we would give him credit for which he could use to purchase military equipment. I believe that came at that time, but it was not an idea which was accepted. Probably in 2020 hindsight, very much to our distress. I mean, we would have been better prepared to face the oil shock later on than we were. He suggested storing it in salt, or salt brines. Somehow he knew about it, or somebody told him about it.
Did you attend any of the meetings with the Shaw, or the Shaw attended?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. What impressions of him did you get compared to, say, the earlier 60s? Any changes in him that you might have noticed or that you can recall?
Well, I suppose to a degree he was much more assured. Forceful is not quite the word, but confident, relaxed, knowledgeable. After all, he had by that time talked to and known many of our presidents, from Roosevelt on up, innumerable secretaries of state, secretaries of defense, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, etc., etc. So he, and of course he'd by that time been a world traveler and received heads of state and government in Iran. In other words, you know, he had arrived as a ruler and conducted himself accordingly, at least from his life. I didn't, on the other hand, I didn't detect any arrogance. He didn't behave that way. I mean, he was straightforward, businesslike, you know. Always on the formal side. I mean, he would address the Secretary of State as Mr. Secretary of State. Do you realize, or I would like you to know, or this is what I think. I mean, he's quite formal. He's I guess that's about it.
Okay. I should mention this earlier. In summer 69, Nixon gave a speech in Guam, the Nixon Doctrine speech. Did that have any special bearing or on policy towards Iran in this period? Was there a connection made?
I'm confident that we fed that into our preparations for the state visit, and it was taken into account in how we presented the issues involved and how we presented our recommendations as to what the appropriate response might be. Yeah.
Okay. I asked a question on petroleum issues during the early 70s. In late 1970, after Libya raised prices first, I think, and the OPEC countries met at Caracas, declared their intention to take over oil pricing. Do you recall how the State Department responded to this, these first moves by OPEC? And this might be a little too specific.
Well, my perspective was insofar as Iran was concerned.
Right.
The reaction there. The Shah, in effect, sort of matched that increase. And word got back to us that, in a sense, no two-bit Colonel Upstart is going to show me how to conduct international oil affairs. So that was a factor in the beginning of the escalation of oil prices. I wasn't the only one, of course. I mean, Shah knew international, he and John Sheeta Muzaggar at that time, and John Sheeta was Minister of Finance and Economic Finance. But he was the one that almost always dealt with oil questions as far as Iran had a delegate to OPEC. And they knew the oil thing very well, and so were able to deal with it in quite realistic terms. In other words, what were the market forces, what was supply and demand, who the players were and all that. Again, they both been dealing with this for a long time and we're very experienced. So that's why I suppose the sort of remark that no two-bit upstart colonel was going to outshine it. As far as I know, it was never made public, but we got back this one way or another.
Now, during this period, John J. McCloy was working with oil corporations and trying to formulate what's called a joint approach vis-a-vis OPEC. Oil corporations worked together against OPEC and a joint approach.
Well, again, I don't remember the exact timing, but the oil companies came in to see the State Department. They were getting concerned, and as I mentioned to you earlier, normally the oil companies did not bother to look to the U.S. government to provide them with guidance or assistance. And they felt they'd do their own thing, and generally did. But this was becoming quite serious and difficult, and the feeling was it was beyond the capabilities of individual oil companies to deal with these issues separately. The obvious question arose as to whether some kind of joint approach would be in violation of the antitrust regulations and laws. And I forget precisely who it was. It may have been the State Department, but in any event, the question was formally presented to Justice. And as I recall, and one would have to get precise documents, but in effect, I think that this was not. And it was sort of the ground rules were laid out, but that it would not be something that the Justice Department would object to. Being lawyers involved in all of this, I'm sure, as a matter of fact, I know it was all very carefully spelled out, but in legal terms, but the upshot of it was that there was an agreement between the oil companies and the State Department that we would undertake to speak to the foreign governments, not with the oil company brief in hand, but that we would speak with the various producing countries, not all of them, but some of them, to discuss these issues of pricing and production and nationalization and its effects, etc. Of course, Iran, as you know, nationalized its oil many years previous, so that wasn't an issue so far as Iran was concerned. All of this led up to an admission by then Under Secretary of State Jack Irwin to the area. I was on that mission. Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Kuwait. Let's see which North African country. I believe that those were four countries. Spoke to Jack, saw the Shah in Iran, of course, saw the Emir in Kuwait, etc., etc.
Now, what was the upshot of the meeting with the Shah on Huzigar? I read that Irwin abandoned the joint approach idea. MacArthur suggested that he abandon it, take a different tack. I'm not sure about the details.
I'm not sure I know what you mean by saying he abandoned the joint approach idea.
The idea of having the oil corporations take a collective approach towards dealing with OPEC, that idea was dropped. If I'm oversimplifying it, I think maybe.
No, I think you're right there, because we felt that there were different conditions and different considerations involved. Say in Iran, vis-a-vis Saudi Arabia, vis-a-vis Kuwait or Indonesia. And one of them, of course, was the fact that nationalization was not an issue as far as Iran was concerned. What the other differences and issues were, I'm sorry, I just don't remember with any clarity or precision. My general impression of the mission, and I'm sure the archives contain, Jack wrote a report to the president about the mission and what he felt had been achieved or not achieved. Basically, it was that we had made our views known at the appropriate level, that we were confident that they would be taken into serious consideration in terms of these countries' actions and behavior in the future. I don't recall that, and we had not intended to be a negotiating mission. It wasn't. It was more a, here's the way we see things, and we're glad to listen to what you feel about the issues, kind of exercise.
I read somewhere that during these meetings, around this time, the Shah threatened to shut down production in the Persian Gulf if the corporation took a collective approach towards OPEC. Do you call this kind of a threat being made or at that time?
Yeah. No, I don't.
No.
I seriously doubt if he did make it. I mean, it's not a credible threat, and I don't think he would have made it for that reason. And certainly, if he did make it, why we wouldn't have taken it very seriously. That's why I say I don't remember it. I mean, just logic suggests that it was not.
Okay. Before we turn to the fall 1973 oil price explosion, I'd like to turn to the May 72 meeting between Nixon, Kissinger, and the Shah in Tehran. I think they were coming back from Moscow,
right,
south of Tehran.
Right.
Do you recall? Did you hear accounts or read reports of those meetings when you were, let's say?
We didn't really get at line my level an account of what transpired. As I recall, it was a very brief stopover. with the major exception that we understood that Shaw and the President had to discuss the military, as they always did, the sort of the international scene. But then when it got down to specifically bilateral relations and the military situation, I believe this was at the point where the President had concluded that our interests would best be assured by being or helping regional friends to assume some of the security obligations that we had sort of implicitly held previously. Iran and Saudi Arabia would be pillars of that we would build on stability in the area. And that does remind me that was actually in our recommendations at the beginning of the administration. Now that I think about it, I remember that the two pillars we thought Saudi was frankly not going to be a very strong pillar, at least in the early days. I mean, it was sort of ludicrous, but still that was the general approach. And we should not be questioning the Shah's judgments as closely and as intensely as we have in the past. And that, after all, it was his country, and he'd been there running things for a long time with reasonable success, and we ought to listen to respectfully to what he had to say about his needs and demands. We're not necessarily going to be able to respond to it fully, but at least he was the one that would decide.
Was this change in approach? And did you know that was in the works before this meeting? Was there any policy review?
No, I can't recall any direct direct evidence that this rather sharp departure from the past was in the offing. No. So I suppose one would like to conclude that it emerged, President and or Kissinger's thinking, as a result of their travels to Moscow and reassessment, if you will, of the environment in the area, not the world.
Okay. Well, I read that during the year or so before, sometime before those meetings in Tehran in May 72, that Shah might have threatened or suggested that he would turn the Soviet Union for more and more weapons unless the U.S. gave him more access to American weapons producers for its military requirements.
Well, I don't know that he ever explicitly quote threatened, unquote, to do that. The fact is that even much earlier, he had made it clear to us on various occasions that if we weren't able or willing to be forthcoming to his, what he felt were his legitimate military needs, that there were viable alternatives. MiGs, for example, from the French, or tanks from the British, etc. And also, there was a sort of low-level military supply from the supply relationship from the Soviet Union, his armed forces, ground forces, getting trucks and rifles and things like that. So, you know, to sort of, he might have might have implied that, well, again, if we weren't forthcoming, this could escalate into something beyond that. It might escalate to the point of maybe. I really don't remember precisely that, but I don't find it unimaginable.
Do you think that the balance of payments considerations might have influenced Nixon's decision to increase the Shah's ability to buy U.S. weapons, as a way to improve the export situation, given the dollar crisis the previous year?
Yes. Oh well, let me say this. This was always sort of one of the boilerplate rationales for providing that. And by the way, this will help improve our balance of payments. But it wasn't a prime consideration. It's just sort of this was an additional benefit.
What's decision about Shah's ability to buy in the U.S. Weapons market was, once that decision was made, was there any criticism of it from other agencies? Were there any debates or discussions over the policy?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, the presidential decision within our system of government, as many presidents have said themselves, doesn't necessarily mean the bureaucracy won't snap to and march out in the direction that they've been pointed in. Considerable debate, the president's decision was put in a memo, which was sent to the heads of the appropriate agency, specifically Department of Defense, Secretary of State, etc. This was known. This was a presidential decision. But when you get down to the implementation, why the bureaucracy, some of them did not accept this philosophically or for whatever other reason, would still argue and debate the question. So while I knew, I had, as far as I was concerned, I had my marching orders. And I knew that in the debates I was going to prevail. It wasn't something that, you know, everybody just fell into line overnight.
Well, who was especially critical? Which agencies? Was it people in the Pentagon? Were there criticisms or problems?
Well, there were some people who just felt Shah shouldn't have these things. What their reasons for this were, I never really entirely sure, but they just felt, you know, we shouldn't have it. It wasn't right, and then you got a lot of other kinds of arguments about the absorptive capacity and the maintenance, and there was certain legitimacy to that, no doubt. I mean, one did have to, I don't think the Nixon administration or the President or Kissinger per se, they didn't get into detail like that, but they would object to people raising these kinds of questions, and indeed we raised them with the Iranians themselves on a continuing basis, you know. Now you've got to make plans about this. You've got to develop a support system for all of these things you're getting in. You've got to realize what's involved here, and it gets more and more complex as the equipment or the systems themselves get more and more complex. So this was part of an ongoing debate. But there were people who just felt, you know, it shouldn't happen. And when it got to that kind of a question, then one could rely on the president's directive.
How do you think this decision worked out in practice? How would you assess it in practice, this decision to increase the Shah's ability to buy weapons? Was he able to deal with maintenance and training questions successfully?
Well, there were horrendous problems involved in terms of organization and management and all of that training, all the rest of it, no doubt about it. If I recall, this meant that our military technical assistance presence in Iran, which had grown smaller at one stage, began to grow again. And then you had a lot of civilian contractors there who were providing support for systems that they had built or manufactured. So that the overall American presence in Iran ballooned. When I went there in 1974, it was growing, and it sort of peaked at about, I'm not talking about just the official, far from it, because you had a lot of private American companies, nothing to do with defense or anything else over there, doing very good business. But we must have had about 50,000 or maybe more Americans in Iran.
In his book, Gary Sick's very critical of the decisions, the 1972 decisions about arms sales to the Shah. He suggested this was a policy where the tail was wagging the dog, as he put it. How would you respond to that kind of criticism? I think you mentioned earlier the other day that you had problems with his interpretation in that first chapter.
Well, no, my problems with Gary's introduction to I think it may have been those. That's what he said.
Yeah, that's the term.
Precisely. I would have not agreed with that. Just generally, I his characterization of the Shah and the regime and the Shah's perception of himself and perception of Iran, I did not feel was entirely accurate from my perspective, anyhow. And long-term association with Iran. I didn't object at all to Gary's account of what happened in the fall of the Shah, what happened in Washington. But I wasn't involved in that either, so I had no basis for coming up. It was just a sort of setting the framework, as it were, that I didn't really agree with.
I've read that as a condition for taking responsibility to play a more active role in the Persian Gulf, the Shah also asked Nixon for CIA help for the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq. Did you know about this decision at the time, at that time in 72?
This is an area I really don't think I can get into. It's quite a complicated thing, and I don't think I have free to talk about that.
I have a couple other regional type questions to ask. Mm-hmm. Besides this Kurdish issue, the Shah gave support to the Sultan of Oman during this period, who was,
that's
I guess,
right,
trying to suppress a guerrilla insurgency in his country.
That's right. And sent troops there.
Yeah. Did the U.S. discuss this with him, or did the U.S. encourage him to take any action along those lines, or?
I don't recall that we got into any specific discussion with the Shah on this. We may have. I mean, the Helms may have discussed this
point. Okay. You can start. Yeah, it's on. Start the answer.
Well, I don't recall that specifically that it was discussed with him, although it might have been. I really don't know about that. Let me put it this way. I certainly don't recall that we ever suggested that it was an unhelpful thing to do. think we might have, well, I know that we were very interested in Iranian military performance there, and there was sort of a critique, several critiques coming out from the other side, the Gulf, about their behavior, which generally was they were very brave, but obviously inexperienced, and sometimes not terribly well disciplined, so that you got a mixed picture of their performance, but that as they did grow in experience, they became more effective. Certainly in broad general terms, the U.S. government was not at all unhappy to see the Sultan getting some assistance, since he was viewed as a friend of ours, and a friend of our general policy in the area.
Another regional issue was the Shah's seizure of the Tums Islands, I guess sometime in 71, thereabouts.
Did he Greater and Lesser Tums in Abu Musa, yes.
Did the Shah give any advance notice about this this move?
Yes.
How did he explain it?
Well, this was done very secretly, very confidentially. The British deeply involved as a special envoy. And thing was set up in advance. In other words, the people that were on these islands knew that it was going to happen, or at least they were supposed to know, and the rulers had been told about it. This was more a British operation than the U.S. We were informed, but the British were really the ones that were doing this. And so I guess it was on when the Iranians arrived, the local commander either hadn't gotten the word or didn't want to listen to it or something like that. So there was some gunfire exchange and some people killed, not very many, I don't remember how many. But we all said, well, you know, this was ridiculous because the thing had already been planned from the outset. And on, I guess, on Abu Musa, where it had gone according to schedule, why the local commander was out there, greeted the Iranian troops, and then paraded down the street together.
Let me just turn this over.